Go ahead and call this meeting to order. Did you do the pro meetings?
No.
No, I'm just kidding. Thanks.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, we'll go to council roll call.
John Buick,
present.
Eric Dwayne,
present.
Alexis Federico,
here.
Robert McDonald,
pending.
Catherine Morrison, Michael Radigan, Scova Rhodes,
here.
Stephen Vargas,
here.
Stephanie Wade,
present.
We have quorum.
All right, thank you. Go ahead and move into our presentations. We have a Brown Act refresher. So does our audience today.
Good afternoon. My name is John Cleveland, and I'm here to give you a Brown Act refresher for 2026. I'm the Senior Deputy County Counsel. I'm Office Counsel. Today, we're going to talk about the Brown Act's key definitions and basic rules, standing and ad hoc committees, meetings and agendas. We're going to cover a few frequently asked questions along the way, public participation, teleconferencing, the new SB 707, public's access to documents, and violations and enforcement. So this is probably the most important page or slide in the presentation. It covers the basics and it talks about the goals of the Brown Act. Brown Act is designed to ensure public participation, open and public meetings with meaningful public access, and to avoid misuse of the democratic process. Generally, agendas need to be posted 72 hours in advance, and items not appearing on that agenda cannot be acted upon or discussed. The basic rule of the Brown Act is that meetings of legislative bodies must be open and public, and that deliberations and meetings must be open to the public so that the public participation in government can be facilitated and there will be no misuse of the government legislative process. There's a few key concepts and definitions that we need to be aware of and that shape the entire applicability of the Brown Act. Two of them are legislative body and local agency. Let's start with local agency. Local agency obviously is a county, and a legislative body includes commissions, boards, councils, such as OCBAC. There's another rule for standing committees of a legislative body. Standing committees are subject to the Brown Act. Standing committee is a committee that has continuing subject matter jurisdiction or a meeting schedule fixed by charter, ordinance, resolution, or formal action followed by legislative. So here's a quick question. If a standing committee is comprised of less than a quorum of the governing body, is it still subject to the Brown Act? The answer is yes. If it has continuing subject matter jurisdiction or has a meeting schedule fixed by formal action of the legislative body. So just be aware of that as you decide to whether to form a standing committee, or maybe a temporary ad hoc committee that has a limited purpose. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Standing committees are basically treated as extensions of actual legislative body itself that are subject to the Brown Act's open meeting requirements. So here's that exception for ad hoc or temporary committees of a legislative body. The code says a temporary ad hoc advisory committee composed solely of members of the body, not outside experts or community members, that's less than a quorum of the legislative body is not itself a legislative body. That ad hoc committee doesn't have to comply with the Brown Act's public notice and meeting requirements. The temporary advisory committee must serve a single purpose, not be perpetual, and be dissolved once its task is completed. Here's another quick question. So if the legislative body creates an ad hoc committee and states that the ad hoc will not have continuing jurisdiction so as to fall squarely within that exception for ad hocs, but the ad hoc ends up exercising continuing subject matter jurisdiction and it's not limited in time, is that ad hoc now subject to the Brown Act requirements? The answer is yes. If substance controls over, there could be a situation, and there have been, where ad hocs have a scope creep, they last too long, they go too far, and they need to be eliminated, and then a proper ad hoc scenario needs to be reformed. So here's another definition for you. Brown Act applies to meetings. If you don't have a meeting, then the act may not apply, but a meeting is a congregation of a majority of the members of the legislative body at the same time, place, or location to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item that is within the subject matter jurisdiction. So it's important to note that it is here discuss, deliberate, or take action. It's not just formal votes. The defined term meeting includes gatherings, including where members discuss the subject matter jurisdiction of a legislative body, and those gatherings can be informal, such as meals, social events, not just a situation where everyone's gathered around the table in a building like this and taking votes. So there's a concept called serial meetings. Serial meetings are prohibited. The serial meeting could inadvertently infer where you have a daisy chain scenario or a hub and spoke scenario, and the positions of members are being communicated from one to another, thereby creating a serial meeting. The use of serial meetings or communications is prohibited and needs to be avoided. However, one-way briefings, such as staff briefings to the legislative body, are permitted. Staff members or other members of the public may interact with members of the legislative body to provide information, answer questions, provide reports, so long as they don't act as go-betweens between those legislative body members and make the positions of each legislative body member known to the others. Similarly, a legal memorandum from County Council does not constitute a meeting within the Brown Act. So here's a quick question regarding digital communications. Are BCC members limited regarding the items they can or can't discuss via email, text, social media? Yes. Serial meetings are prohibited even when using electronic communications. Brown Act prohibits the use of a series of communications, including emails, texts, or social media, to discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of business with the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. So you got to be careful about emails where there's a reply all possible. That's where it comes up most frequently. A BCC member cannot respond directly to any communication on a social media platform that's made, posted, or shared by another member of the legislative body if the post is related to matters within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. So this could inadvertently come up if one member likes a post posted by another member, thereby communicating a position on that social media platform. The same rule applies to internet chat rooms, blog dialogues, or other online dialogues. All right, so let's just do a quick recap on these technologies.
Hey, John, quick question. Yes. You referenced BCCs, blind copies. Any reason why?
You know, there is an abbreviation in some of these slides regarding boards, commissions, or councils.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I apologize.
Using a BCC on an email is a great way to avoid that reply all scenario that I referenced. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I said you meant blind copy. Sorry.
Yeah. If you see BCC in here, probably means Board of Counseling. So when can a prohibited serial meeting inadvertently occur? Replying all to an email message, discussing an email in a chat room, posting a like on a social media platform, discussing an issue on a platform where messages appear only temporarily and disappear, or deploying a digital surrogate to advocate for issues within your subject matter jurisdiction with other members of the legislative body. The answer, of course, is E, F, all of the above. Let's talk about six exceptions to the definition of media. So there are six exceptions. They're narrow definitions, narrow exceptions, and they are fact specific. This slide is designed to provide you with a general overview and make you aware that the exceptions exist. If you think that you're coming up on a scenario where one or more of them may apply, I encourage you to contact staff. We can get in contact with county council. We could work through the requirements of any of them or all of them and make sure that you fall within the scope of the exception. There's an exception for individual contacts and conversations, such as those one-way briefings we discussed in the past. By the way, all of these exceptions are predicated on the assumption that the legislative members won't be discussing subject matter jurisdiction issues at the conference or individual contacts or community meetings. There's also an exception for conferences open to the public that address issues of general interest to the public. An exception for community meetings, open to the public and publicized. And there's an exception for open and notice meetings of another local agency. And there's an exception for purely social or ceremonial occasions, such as weddings, funerals, farewells. And finally, an exception for open and notice standing committee meetings, provided the members only observe in the audience. All right, let's talk a little bit about agenda requirements for regular meetings, Brown Act meetings. The legislative body must post a time and place for regular meetings, and those regular meetings generally must occur within the boundary of the jurisdiction. The agenda must be posted 72 hours in advance at a location freely accessible to members of the public and posted on the agency's website. And the agenda must contain a brief general description of each item of business to be transacted or discussed. And here's a really important part. Except as allowed by a law with very limited exceptions, no action or discussion shall be taken on any item not appearing on the posted agenda. So if you find yourself in a meeting and something hasn't been properly agendized, the best course of action is to, of course, refrain from discussing or taking action on it. Direct staff to put that item on a future agenda so that you can properly agendize it and take action at a future date. There's also special meetings under the Brown Act with a short notice period. Special meetings can be set by the presiding officer of the legislative body or by a majority of the members of the legislative body by posting notice and delivering notice to each member, including members of the media who have requested in advance notice of such meetings. 24 hours in advance. The call on the notice must specify the time and the place, just like regular meetings, and the items to be discussed. Same rule applies. No business other than what's on that agenda may be conducted during special meetings. Finally, a brief mention of emergency meetings. Emergencies are defined as work stoppage, crippling activity, and other activity that impairs the public health safety of the boat. And emergency meetings are allowed to be noticed with telephonic notice, which is much shorter. Okay, let's talk about the public's right to documents. So when do documents related to agendas need to be made public? There's a couple of different time frames that apply depending on when the documents are provided to the legislative body and who prepared them. If the board receives the materials more than 72 hours in advance, then the materials are public records and they need to be available for the public to inspect at the office of the legislative body and hopefully posted as part of the agenda packet. If a member of the legislative body or staff prepared the materials and the legislative body materials are received during the actual meeting, the public must have access to the materials during the meeting. If someone outside of the agency prepared the materials and gave them to the legislative body during the meeting, somebody comes up and hands you a bunch of material documents, the public must have access to those materials after the meeting. Finally, if the legislative body members receive the materials less than 72 hours before the regular meeting, the materials must be made available to the public and available for inspection at the same time. The legislative body can't get a head start. They need to be available to the public and provided to the legislative body at the same.
So a special meeting is 24-hour notice. Do the same rules apply as far as the materials? It has to be posted 24 hours before or at the meeting?
Can I ask you a question? Let me research that and get back to you.
Appreciate it. I'll leave you my card. It just happened this morning to me.
SB 707 changed the Brown Act in a variety of ways. There's really two general categories. There's changes that apply to eligible legislative bodies, such as the Board of Supervisors or City Councils. And then there's changes that apply to all legislative bodies, including those that are classified as not eligible legislative bodies, such as advisory BCCs and OCFAM. SB 707 recast the old AB 361 and AB 2449 teleconferencing options. We had COVID. Everyone liked teleconferencing and the special flexibilities that COVID gave us. Then there was AB 361, AB 2449. Those provisions were set to sunset, and the legislature passed SB 707 to make some of them permanent. Others are expiring in 2030. So now the emergency and just cause provisions have been combined, and there's new provisions and flexibilities for teleconferencing for people who have disabilities. And we will get into the details of those in the coming slides. But many of SB 707's changes do not affect advisory BCCs. The key changes that are relevant to OCVAC include providing you with a copy of the Brown Act that I understand you've already received, teleconferencing due to a disability, reorganizing in the teleconferencing roles, removal, clarifying that removal and muting is allowed during teleconferencing, and clarification regarding the recording of meetings. Everyone, all meetings can generally be recorded, and that open question is now clarified and stated affirmatively in the new code sections. So we'll cover these point by point. First one, obviously, Brown Act copy must be distributed to members. Second is this new allowance for teleconferencing for members with a disability. And the disability is defined by applicable law, namely the ADA. Members may participate remotely as a reasonable accommodation. Their participation is considered in person for determining quorum. The members do not need to meet the other standard teleconferencing requirements that have existed in the Brown Act for a number of years, such as posting an agenda on the front door of a hotel room where the meeting may be. And BCC members must use audiovisual technology unless their disability requires them to participate off camera, and must disclose before any action is taken whether any other adults are in the room and their relationship to those adults. We're going to get into the details on that a little bit more. It's a preview slide. Here's a quick note on the general teleconferencing reorganization of emergency meetings and just cause. I give you the new code sections here for your reference. And like I said, the just cause and emergency circumstances allowances were combined and edited. The rules have various complicated conditions and limitations. We're going to get into an overview of some of those. But again, if you think that you are interested in availing yourself to these provisions, I'd encourage you to talk to staff who can involve county council and we can work through it. So the next few slides talk about teleconferencing under the traditional Brown Act rules that have been around for quite some time. Teleconferencing for members with a disability in greater detail, teleconferencing under that state of emergency and just cause, and teleconferencing for a new set of teleconferencing flexibilities called eligible subsidiary bodies, if authorized by the Board of Supervisors. That's important. Okay, the first one is the traditional Brown Act rules. As you probably recall, anyone can teleconference under the normal Brown Act, but the notice requirements and access requirements are pretty aggressive. The agenda must be posted at locations where the member is teleconferencing from, such as a hotel room on vacation. Members of the public must be able to access that location. There's no limit on in terms of frequency, and quorum for the overall legislative body must be met in the physical location where the meeting is occurring within the jurisdiction. And let's move on to the new teleconferencing for members with a disability. There's No frequency limit here, but it is based on an ADA accommodation for a disability. Remote participation is allowed, and it counts as quorum. The traditional teleconferencing rules we just covered are waived. The agenda is posted normally, and access is provided to the main legislative body location, but not to the members of the location who is teleconferencing. All right, teleconferencing under a state of emergency. Under SB 707, the state of emergency includes state declared or proclaimed states of emergency, as well as local agency states of emergency, such as a state of emergency declared by board of supervisors or maybe a city council. This provision allows entirely remote meetings. The majority of the body must find an imminent health or safety risk, and the state of emergency must be reconfirmed and findings made every 45 days. You might remember that from COVID, where they had to keep making the findings again and again. Quorum is achieved if met, even if all members are remote. No in-person quorum requirement. So it's an emergency. Yeah, everyone can be remote. Agenda must include the teleconferencing details for members of the public, describing how members of the public can access that meeting, and the findings regarding the existence of that state of emergency must be documented. And public have to have the same two-way audiovisual opportunity to participate in the meeting. All right, let's talk about just cause. Under just cause, you can telecommute or teleconference for caregiving of pretty much immediate family members, illness, official travel, or military service. And that military service is a new one. Two-way audiovisual is required as usual. The minutes must denote the statutory basis for the remote appearance, and in-person quorum is required. There are frequency limits depending on the number of times the legislative body meets throughout the year. So there's an allowance for members to avail themselves of this flexibility two times per year if the legislative body meets once per month or less. The agenda is posted as usual. Remote participation needs to be noted in the minutes. And the public attends the primary physical location while the member participates remotely via audio or video. Okay, let's talk about teleconferencing under this new eligible subsidiary body provision. As you can see on the slide, the requirements are quite complicated, and this is just touches the surface here, but there is now an allowance for eligible subsidiary bodies that have a variety of requirements, and they need to be generally advisory, not have primary subject matter jurisdiction over a few sensitive subject matters, such as taxes, and licenses to permits. And then the Board of Supervisors needs to grant and make findings in allowing the eligible subsidiary body to use this allowance and make continuing findings every 6 months thereafter. There's no specific frequency limit, but the elected officials and the Board of Supervisors have the discretion to continue to make the findings and allow it or not. The agenda must specify the teleconference option and the basis for the approval, and the eligible subsidiary body shall post the agenda at a physical meeting location, but need not post the agenda at the remote location, wherever we has been granted authority to teleconference from. The public access via a physical location, there needs to still be one physical location where members of the public can come in and participate with the members who are teleconferencing under this provision. Okay. Switch gears here to another part of SB 707 called removal. Removal has been clarified to include the ability of the legislative body to mute or remove individuals from the audiovisual means of telecommuting if there is a disruption that impedes the work of the legislative body. So basically, the legislature has just clarified the applicability of normal disruption rules to teleconferencing. The legislature also clarified that a legislative body may only prohibit the recording of a meeting when there is a persistent disruption of the meeting. The general rule is open meetings may be recorded. Okay, public participation in open public meetings. So during a regular meeting, members of the public must have an opportunity to speak on any item appearing on the agenda before that agenda item is acted upon. There also needs to be an opportunity for members of the public to address the legislative body on any item of interest within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. Meetings are open. Secret ballots are not allowed, and the minutes need to reflect the votes for actions taken legislative. There are some exceptions for discussing non-agenda items. The general rule is obviously the legislative bodies cannot act on items not appearing on the agenda, but members of the legislative body may briefly respond to comments or statements or questions posed by members of the public or audience on their own initiative or by vote. They may make a brief announcement, make a brief report on their activities, provide a reference to staff for factual information, request staff report back to the body at a subsequent meeting concerning any matter, or direct staff to place the matter of business on a future agenda. Who enforces the Brown Act? The district attorney or any interested person may bring a lawsuit through mandamus, a lawsuit for an injunction, or the third degree, stop or prevent violations, or threaten violations, or address past violations. Attorney's fees and court costs are available to a plaintiff, and this can serve as a deterrent and a cautionary kind of tale of why the Brown Act's details need to be complied with. As a recap, there's a variety of actions related to Brown Act, alleged Brown Act violations that include actions to invalidate, actions to determine whether past action constitute a violation, or actions to prevent future violations. And this slide also is just for awareness. There's a variety of requirements and procedures for each type of legal action. There's deadlines that apply to each of them. And there's also potential responses that the legislative body can take in terms of curing, correcting, and responding. So if you ever encounter an allegation of a Brown Act violation, again, please work with staff, county council. There is also the potential for criminal enforcement of the Brown Act when a member intends to deprive the public of information which the member knows or has reason to know the public is entitled to receive. And this question comes up a decent amount. Do the board, commissions, or council's bylaws supersede the Brown Act's requirements or vice versa? No, the bylaws do not supersede the Brown Act. Brown Act requires compliance with the Brown Act in all cases. The Brown Act trumps the violence. That concludes my presentation. Thank you very much. And let me know if you have any general questions, any sensitive questions, really fact-specific questions, or questions that might require legal research. Best address outside of the public meeting. But up to you.
Thank you, John. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, so there's three actions that you take in executive session. Real estate transactions, if you're discussing buying a building of some sort, real estate, right?
You said executive session?
Executive session. Isn't executive session covered by the Brown Act? Going into executive session?
I'm not familiar with the term executive session.
Closed session. That's what I'm
saying. But these advisory BCC is life architects don't.
We don't do those. Okay, perfect. I just want to make sure. Thank you.
Yeah, the grounds for closed session don't come up, so.
Yeah, thank you.
That's not what you did there. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
That's not what you were doing there.
Thank you, Dan.
Move into public comments this time. Members of the public may address the council regarding any items within the subject jurisdiction, provided that no action is taken on off-agenda items unless authorized by law. Do we have any public comments?
We do. We have Corey Vigil from Strong Family, Strong Children, and American Legion Post 291.
Corey Vigil.
Hello, everybody. My turn on?
Yes.
All right. So I did send flyers to Stephanie Wade and Bobby McDonald whenever they get a chance. They'll send me the flyers so you can all have visuals. Yeah. Well, there's about five of them on there that I think are pertinent to the county. I know all of you represent different districts, but we have a couple of events that are coming up that I thought I would, kind of be the eyes and ears for you for the for this group here to let you know like larger events that are going, because I know you all are very occupied. But the big one that's coming up is March 21st, which is the Suicide Rock March. It's our third year. We already have 200 people registered for that event. And again, you'll get the flyers from Stephanie and Bobby. So we did it the last couple of years. We started off at the pier in Huntington Beach. So the city's on board. The mayor and all them will be speaking at the beginning. We're registering everybody. We meet at 0800, and then we have a couple of, words of engagement and what we're trying to accomplish. And then 0900, we all leave. We do 6.8 miles. You can either put the ruck, which is similar to like a backpack, if you want to put weight in there or not, or we just have people that are just walking it, or people are participating. It's only $22. Again, we have over 200 people registered. And some people are just going to meet us at the American Legion in Newport. So we're going from the Huntington Beach to Newport, the American Legion in Newport. And then there we'll have a resource fair for veterans. And then we're having a barbecue with band, DJ, all that. And so there's going to be a lot of vendors set up from a lot of important agencies in Orange County. And again, we're going to be talking about when we say that we're trying to talk about the suicide, we want to give a couple statistics and, some of the things that we're really doing, like boots on the ground to try to address that so we can educate people. Because it's one thing to say that you're trying to combat suicide, but people need to know exactly how you're doing that. So they need context. So that's what we try to give them at the beginning and the end of this event. Again, you'll get the flyer on this. Another focus that we have is April 5th, we had our Veterans Coffee Talk, which is, we have it usually every first Saturday of the month. And it's, we approximately had close to 118 attendees. So it's been consistent. I think the lowest amount we've had maybe has been 68, but we're hitting close to 100 every single time. So the majority of the veterans that attend that are senior veterans. But we're right now we're getting a really, really large turn up for a lot of the female veterans. So we have a group that started over there with Genevieve Dominguez, who's our first vice, and our last group. She has a group coming in on the 14th, and we're averaging close to 40 women vets. And we just started this only 2 months ago. So I want to continue to collaborate. I'd like to, be more involved with the ladies. The lady veterans here, and with you, Bobby McDonald, because I know you're instrumental with the Nunavis, and maybe we could coordinate. So I'm putting it on the same day as your events, that way we can really try to help these women veterans. After the Veterans Coffee Talk, we started a cloud computing training for senior veterans, which went really well in the hut over at our Legion. So after the Veterans Coffee Talk, we had quite a few senior veterans, and we open it up to anybody, showing them how to work their phones to try to get access to services. That seems to be one of the barriers to our senior veterans or just veterans in general. And so we want to show them how to work, the iPhone, how to work the Android, if they're working a tablet, just basic stuff to get them started. So we can try to at least get them, get them access. I mean, data has shown that many of you have studied the suicide component here, and the numbers are extremely high for suicide, where many of them were not even attached to the VA, to the Department of Veterans Affairs. So that's the data that we've learned, that we've taken. So we're trying to implement that and to boots on the ground to see what we can do. Another area of focus is
near time.
Okay. I continued the military family 101 training. So you guys will get a flyer on that. So we're educating a lot of people on how to work with veterans. So it's been approved by National VFW, American Legion, and then we also have like Dr. Kelly and some of the mental health in Orange County that have approved this training, and it comes through with strong families, strong children. You guys will get the flyers here shortly, okay? Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Colby.
Do we have any other public comments?
No other public comments.
Okay. Go ahead and move into executive report, chair report. First, I want to say thank you to Seal Beach, the city of Seal Beach, for allowing us the use of their chambers. And I want to say thanks to staff for setting that up. I know we were shooting for Leisure World, but in like a secure compound. And so we would have to have like, yeah, it's a little bit difficult to get in there. So really appreciate that. I will make sure that when before I leave today, I'll say something to somebody at the front counter for that. It's Women's History Month, right? We have women veterans present today. We have women veterans in general. There are a number of women's veterans events, things that help them adjust, things that help them find jobs, things that help them connect and things of that nature. If you know of women veterans, I have a ton of them at Cerritos College where I work and advise. Make sure that you're hopefully providing some resources for them. And if you do have any resources, by all means, you can send them to the county and the county can distribute them to each of us while following the Brown Act. So do it the right way. It's also National Brain Injury Month. There may be a few of us in this room that have some experience with that. We have a lot of our comrades, compatriots who may have suffered traumatic brain injury or some type of brain injury. The takeaway message for that is if it's identifiable, I would say treat it with compassion. The world could use, I heard that the world needs love, sweet love, but they need a lot more compassion too. If you know somebody like that, if there's somebody in your life that has some type of brain injury, this month is a National Brain Injury Awareness Month. I did send out some things without violating the Brown Act about the Iraqi campaign mail. Now, this is similar to those of us who are both war veterans, too, first time around. Both the country, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, they struck their own medals to commemorate the liberation of Kuwait. Iraq did something similar a few years ago. However, in Iraqi fashion, they only made, I think they struck one medal and they gave the then President Biden the only medal that given to anyone and not somebody who actually served in the conflict. And so there is a grassroots effort currently to try and get Congress to approve something like that. Of course, there are some legislation hurdles, and there's also some DoD guidelines. DoD requires said country to produce the number in a distributable amount, which is probably like a million. So I don't know if it's going to happen, but something to keep on your radar for those Iraqi war veterans and those who have them in their lives. A new uppercut came last month, thanks to both Alexis and John for engaging and then re-engaging on 38 CFR 310. Has to do with the ability of the government to be able to weigh in on disability compensation and ratings based on your medicated or treated state, not your overall state, which to many of us on face value seems particularly egregious. It's my understanding that Secretary of War is issued an edict to reduce the DoD budget by 8% every year. Unfortunately, you don't do that on the veterans' backs. All right, so more to that later, but I think that as a body, we would look at taking some form of action after standing up an ad hoc committee and things of that nature. When I became the chair of this council, I mentioned two things that are near and dear to my heart, and that is veteran homelessness and veteran suicide. So thank you to Bobby for bringing that up. I recently I'm a firm believer in leading from the front and giving my pound of flesh first. So I did volunteer for the program called Onward Up, Onward Ops. This is a program that will, once I'm finished trained, will teach me, and I kind of already have an idea of what this looks like, to be a transition coach, a transition partner, a transition person that can deal with veterans before they get discharged, and then into their first and second years in discharge, because there's a 3-year deadly gap that if they lose connectedness, that if they lose the control of their rudder, whatever it is, and they don't have somebody there to throw them a lifeline, our studies show that that's like a number one indicator that they may complete a suicide or attempt suicide. And so I figured, because it's important to me, and I have a recently discharged and service-connected veteran living in my house, that it would be good for me to not only get educated for personal reasons, but for so many other reasons, one of which I'm going to mention. March 2nd marked the anniversary, 3-4 years that Sean took his own life. Sean was Doc Sean Ferguson, who served with us on my second deployment to Iraq in 2006. He was a member of our second detachment who was in Crazy Ramadi in Iraq in 2006 during that deployment of Third Civil Affairs Group, which is now First Civil Affairs Group out of Del Mar, California. But Sean, a couple of years ago, barricaded in place, was armed, and created a law enforcement situation. Unfortunately, I think that things did not develop fast enough for Sean, and Sean completed a suicide by firearm on his own before police could get in there. Up in Sausalito, this is where this happened. And, you know, it's one of those things. He's not the only one, but he's the most recent one. And if we can prevent that on our watch, it's critically important that if you have the time to volunteer to help veterans remain or feel connected, that is one of the number one things that we can as a group affect change on, so that they don't feel so lost and alone, that this is an option for them. One last thing, it's a personal plug, kind of a uplifting, and is that Holy Week is coming upon us for those who celebrate March 29th to the 5th. A performance that is near and dear to my heart, because I know the writers, I know the creators of it, is the Living Lord's Supper. And it's kind of like the Pageant of the Masters meets musical theater. It's a lot of fun. This is going to be, I think, my 6th or 7th time being on stage, being one of the apostles. I played the most important, I would say, arguably Judas. So it's the 3rd year I'm doing it as a Judas.
Somebody else wants the role.
Well, I already got it. Yes. Coincidentally, the first night I played this role, it was the passing of my mother. It was Maundy Thursday, 2023. And it was really neat, whether you're a believer or not. I know that God truly takes care of us. When people came out of the performance, the cast goes into the grand lobby of the Rose Center Theater, which we're fighting for, by the way. The city has tried to do all kinds of sideways things to try and get rid of it, but it's still there. The management team is still there. But coming out into the lobby, there were so many people who came up to me and just were very consoling and, you know, said, oh, wow, that's a tough one. You know, wow, you know, patting me on the back, kind of showing me compassion for having played Judas, having no idea that on that very morning that I lost my mother. And it worked out very well. So it's a role that I'm not going to soon let go of. It's a lot of fun. And it's not heavy, I would say, at all. So if you have time, make time. It's on the 31st. There are 2 performances, I believe, at 6 and 8 p.m. You can look that up, the Rose Center Theater in Westminster, right down the street. And that's all I have for executive report. We'll go ahead and move into our Orange County VSO update with Eric.
All right, great. Thank you. And thank you for the mental health, Corey and Eric, offering the mental health portion of what veterans and their families may experience. We asked for renewal of the Cal Vet for Mental Services Act. from Prop 63, funding for 26, 27, and 27, 28. I'm hopeful that we'll get a chance to get that renewed in the next couple of months. So more to come on that. With the Mental Health Services Act, our navigator has connected with over 80 public and private community organizations to try and make sure we have linkages to families and their families, as well as trying to connect them to the VSOs, file claims. Most significantly, those people who are facing barriers to accessing resources and navigating this broad system of care that's coupled with VA, truly in the state, as well as partnerships. So more to come on that in the coming months. I hope so we'll get granted with an increase of this funding prize that has been quite well. We're entering college tuition fee waiver season here. This is one of our busiest seasons between March all the way up until August. We tend to be very proactive about making sure people have access to the information on the website and how to actually be prepared and file those claims. There's a electronic process that's available where people can come into our office as well to drop off the applications, and we'll still process those electronically for us. We just went through a huge recruitment process and now have a brand new Survivor Veterans Claims representative and three new accredited, soon to be accredited representatives. They're going through their training with PowerLab this week. They've been involved with me over the last 6 to 8 weeks prior to this academy and intensive training on Title 38 to apply those laws to be able to serve them with their families. That's not it. Oh, wait times. I got asked this question at one of the collaborative meetings. We're about 8 business days out for scheduled appointments. So we're taking the walk-ins, get a chance to serve folks virtually from my phone. I think that's been an absolute plus for our office. We've been getting a lot of referrals from Long Beach for some, you know, specifically have jurisdictional boundary to serve them to make sure we have access. We're serving about 30% of our population that's coming from surrounding towns, not just on
that's a legal requirement, right? I mean, for PSOs in the state of California to serve.
But we can't turn them away.
Right.
We can't turn them away.
I think it speaks to the fact that you're getting to be better than you used to be at what you do when people are hearing about it and coming your way, or because we're all giving people the nudge to go to Orange County.
We're amazing.
Yeah, just
you're amazing. You're amazing.
All right. OC for vets, Jason.
Yeah. We still have our 2 clinicians that are stationed at the VSO. We are still looking at how best to utilize them there so that they have place to see. We also have 2 clinicians that are in our housing out in the community, the Mental Health Service Act funded housing. We have 6 sites that have veteran units, and so they're rotating through those sites. We also have one of our contractors hire a veteran peer that we're placing at Bureau of Landing to provide some more on-site services.
All right. Thank you. Moving to our committees, do we have any updates for communications?
Yeah, I've got a couple. I'm double dipping today, but I'll get to the second one in a second. Double dipping today. We had a great fifth anniversary Women's Veterans Mental Health Symposium and benefits. We included benefits this year. The attendance was a little down this year, but it was still great to have Dr. Kelly and then Mayumi Kimura from CalVet, Women's Vet. She was down. And we now have, if you don't know, Elizabeth Rocha, who used to be at Irvine Valley College, is now the veterans representative for Congressman Luca Rea. So they put on a damn good panel. This is our second year at Orange Coast College. And they're top notch. I mean, the campus pulls out, and of course Tom Bosecamp comes in and makes it happen. So we're setting up for next year. I'm gonna have to kill the coffee top talk for any women that wants to go on the first Saturday in March or get rid of Corey. I'll work that out. The other thing is, and I just want to share it with everybody, I'm starting to get phone calls for Memorial Day. So each one of you have your own pretty much supervisorial district. Find out who wants to do Memorial Day, that they either someone to do Pledge of Allegiance, someone to do a keynote, someone just to stand in and offer some remarks. And I'm say off of that. I'm starting to get I'm busy again. So, and then the reason why I'm saying I'm double dipping, the timing's right. I've got to leave because there's a congressional hearing going on with Congressman Lou Correa, Congressman Derek Tran, and there's some key people from the legislature that are here in Los Angeles that are coming down to a meeting that I've got to leave and be there because we're going to talk about the cemetery and some other veterans issues. But I did not want to miss this meeting here.
Okay.
If you have some questions or you need some help, if you want me to volunteer you to speak at one of the Memorial Day or Veterans Day, and let me know. Those are fun things for us to share in the community about what we've done and what we have done. And again, whatever you need, if you want, if you're looking for someone, give me a holler. I might be able to help out. All right. That's my report.
Locations already set up for those ceremonies?
No.
Can he's come up with it?
No. What I'm saying, when you say locations, I mean, I'm saying each one of us has a supervisor, whether it be Mission Gale or Seal Beach or Grand Park. We, as a representative, we should ask if they're looking for, in our five or six, seven, eight cities you have, should maybe ask, are you looking for someone? We should reach out to them because most of them don't know. They all call me.
And I just haven't had testing veterans.
Okay. Yeah, I've spoken on that.
Okay.
Yeah, to that SCOBA, Michael Radigan does our events and outreach, and that is something under the purview of that standing. And if you want to be part of that, you're welcome to.
Yeah, after me.
But most of them want somebody to name me as well.
Okay.
Okay. And don't think Marie used to be part of the name, so don't.
No. Somebody hanging out for a while.
Yeah.
I will be the name.
Bye, guys.
Yeah,
all right.
Hey,
we don't stand
high enough. Anyway, Mr. Chitter, I'm
going to
bail.
Okay. I was just going to start you off of council comments.
Well, I gave you everything I have.
Okay. All barrel. All right.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and move into council comments, and we'll start with Steve.
I have nothing. Thank you.
Cool.
Steve. I'd like to mention that in June, I'm headed to Washington, D.C. for Government Advocacy Week. And I'd like to see if I can take some notes on some subjects that you'd like me to take to our congressmen and senators while we're over there. I've gone a couple of years and there's something really powerful about seeing 120, 130 guys in wheelchairs rolling around the Senate building, knocking on doors. So if you have anything that you'd like to specifically take,
maybe the 38 CFR changes.
Yes.
We're meeting in May.
Because that's coming right to the VA. Well, we have our
And your second item?
Second item is there's a Tustin Veterans Force Park. They have a meeting. So if you guys ever want to utilize that, please let me know.
What is it?
The Veterans
Center. Oh, Tierney Center.
No, really? It's just Tustin.
What is this place?
Well, it's a sports park.
Uh-huh.
Pickleball, tennis.
Sure.
But they also have a nice meeting room with like an AV setup.
Well,
what's the name?
Tustin Veterans Sports Park. Well, SCOBA is, so for the May meeting, we're looking for that, and that's kind of centralized. So that would be a good one.
It's on the Red Elm, Valencia.
Okay.
Open the limitation.
That's
open
the
public
and
handicap.
And parking.
The
ADA compliant. Yeah.
Well, I
know
that.
Well, there you go. I
should be a racist. I'm embarrassed.
Good to go.
But it's on this
so one. Will you work
can
on
you,
that?
Can you research that?
Yeah. You know,
okay.
Thank you.
See what their schedule is like.
Please and thanks. That would be great to have it in May. Okay. Stephen?
I've got one thing. Last month, I was asked to give a talk on transgender veterans, in particular that the transgender veterans were affected by Executive Order 14-181 that kicked out 3,500 transgender troops, the majority of whom were senior folks that were career people. Not many people join on one tour side. It's a good idea to come out as transgender in the military.
Right.
So 3,500 have been sent out on the street. And I want to, my talk basically framed it this way. We were all talking about how important it is to care for each other and for our fellow veterans, and that they're 1.5 times more likely to succumb to suicide.
Yes.
The statistics are that transgender people are 9 times more likely to succumb to suicide. So now if you take that, and we all know that the biggest propensity of suicidality in the veterans community comes with that transition and how hard it is to go from living military values and coming into a civilian population that doesn't understand, care, or support those values. And so these are 3,500 people who not only come into a society that doesn't necessarily share their martial values, but they suffered this moral injury of having their service cut short and being told they were literally dishonest and dishonor them. So, I'm very concerned about these people. I know that there's a bill, AB 1776, here in California, that would prioritize transgender veterans for employment services with the state and for veterans benefits with the state. I'm writing a letter of support for that for an organization I'm affiliated with. But I think the bigger issue is going to be medical care. A lot of these people have not been eligible for military retirement and falling into the VA, where the VA no longer provides gender-affirming care. So now imagine a transgender woman who is suddenly cut off from estrogen and starts losing their hair. These are sort of the things that are going to lend that suicide out. So I just wanted to share that consideration for folks.
Thank you for that.
Thanks. Yeah. I was going to thank Bobby for putting on the women's event that I didn't attend. So it was the last year for my daughter to ride in the Festival of Wales. I just wanted to thank him and really point out, it is Women's History Month. And I just had a talk with my husband on the way over, who is chair of OCTA, and he's giving a speech tonight for the Women in Transportation Conference that's going on. And we just kind of, talked about the importance of male-dominated fields to have, men advocate for women as well. And so I wanted to thank Bobby and everyone who will come on the daily shows your support for really burning the veterans, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the Women's Veteran Empowerment Conference in Weaver?
The Parliament State
Government, Bobby, yeah.
You want to send information or no?
Contact information and I'll connect you.
John? Yeah, just to reiterate what's going on with VA. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on all the departments, DOW, transportation, to make significant cuts. We saw that with DOGE, and there's a lot of pressure on the VA secretary to do the same. What they ultimately saw with this proposal is about $100 million savings by changing veterans medication. We know the second, third effects that will eventually probably lead to an increased suicide risk. With those decisions on disability cuts in claims and disability and ratings can turn into, particularly with people with combat PTSD, if start shortchanging their own medication just because of that. And so there's a horrible second and third effect The great news is the VFW and the American Legion were all over this and really got the secretary, because the secretary was going to shove this down everyone's throat. And they did a great job in having him rescind it. But from a legal standing perspective, it is still there. Public comment ends April 20th. And so we've been told, at least my professional organizations, our lobbyist captain, retired Captain Howard Crawford, says that you need to pick up the phone and call your congressperson, because it just can't be our veterans groups that are advocating this. There needs to be some grassroots following around this issue. We talked about a little bit, I don't know, within the public comment period, that we can do something quick enough from as an ad hoc and maybe a letter to the Board of Supervisors. But that's something that we can discuss.
I have to say, Brown, I recently ran into a change of VHA at VA Long Beach. I needed to be seen. I've had a bunch of skin cancers and had a growth, needed to be seen. And they told me the next available appointment was 4 months out. I said, well, it just needs to be seen to see if it's serious. Sure. Well, it's 4 months. So, all right, well, then refer me to community care.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's a new regulation that once you are established in a clinic, they cannot refer you out to community care, no matter what the waiting is. So I'm going to investigate that some more, but you might want to, problematic. I think that's a way to push veterans out of the VA health system and out going establishing care at clinics and VA, so that you can further say, well, you know, now we're going to study how many veterans are using VA Long Beach. Oh, not that many veterans are using it. Let's close the hospital and go to the community care model we want.
Right.
Yeah.
Could I ask, I'm not aware, I wasn't aware, that once you have a rating, that you could, your rating could be reduced. Could you, for next month, or next meeting, could you give us a little overview of that process of what can be reduced and how it's reduced? Just to educate us, because I never heard that.
They can have you do re-examinations, so there's a number, and you're over it. It's 55.
One of the crazy things also about it is if the CFR is, there are certain diagnoses that they already applied this medic. Good example is hypertension. If you're under control, you know, you can have 0% for hypertension, and that's what Secretary Collins is really looking like, saying we already do this. We're just going to apply it universally.
Yeah.
Just yesterday, I had to inform to my primary care doctor, and he had certified that I was still ill. Because I guess I could have gotten cured in the past. But if you need to be walking, I'd be guilty of fraud. So, yeah. And he said, don't worry, I've had to sign a bunch of these.
Well, yeah, I know a guy. Okay. Thank you to everyone for their comments. My only final parting gift is to thank everyone in the audience today. Thank you for coming today. We really appreciate you. And at that, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting.
I think that's ridiculous.